The vocalese by Rachmaninoff in his own version for soprano and orchestra. Performed tonight by the soprano Svetla Vasilieva and the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Gianandrea Noseda. Reuniting singer, orchestra and conductor, they've all worked together before. Svetla Vasilieva joined them in their recordings of two Rachmaninoff operas, Alieco and Francesca da Rimini. She's a great specialist in Italian opera too. She's something of a Puccini specialist, in fact, with roles in La Bohème, Madame Butterfly and Manon Lescaut. Svetla Vasilieva and Gianandrea Noseda making their way off stage, and the orchestra return to their seats, ready for the finale to this all Rachmaninoff choral prom, a piece that the composer described as a poem for orchestra, chorus and solo voices. The Bells, a setting not of original Russian texts, but of a poem by Edgar Allan Poe, freely adapted by the symbolist writer Constantin Belmont. Now, Rachmaninoff didn't find the poem for himself. He was sent it by an admirer who wanted to remain anonymous, but who thought that the words would be perfect for musical setting. Apparently, the mysterious correspondent was a young cellist, a pupil of one of Rachmaninoff's friends. Now, it had been a while since Rachmaninoff had had the time to compose anything. As a busy concert pianist, he was almost constantly occupied. But his interest was piqued, and in the spring of 1913, he began to make a setting of the poem, finishing it later that year and dedicating it to Willem Mengelberg and the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Now, four different kinds of bells are evoked in Poe's poem, and Rachmaninoff sets each of them as a separate movement. The bells serve as metaphors for different stages of life, starting with the silver sleigh bells of birth, then the golden wedding bells of marriage and adulthood. Brazen alarm bells symbolize life's fears and terrors, and the iron funeral bell tolls through the finale, sonorous and unrelenting. Mariinsky Theatre Chorus, in place here on the risers at the back of the platform on the stage at the Royal Albert Hall, actually took part in the first performance in 1913. A chorus with a great history behind them, extremely famous within Russia, of course, but abroad too, founded back in the 19th century, and the chorus was on hand for the first production of many very famous Russian operas. Works by Borodin, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky. Of course, the chorus was part of the Mariinsky Opera Company, still working in St. Petersburg today. And the orchestra just fine-tuning, ready for the final work in today's programme. The chorus proficient, of course, not just in opera, but also cantatas, oratorios and a cappella works too, and particularly specialising in Russian spiritual music, of which there's a fantastic tradition, of course. Works by Bortnyansky and Gretchaninov. And Rachmaninoff too, of course, his all-night vigil. Well, they're about to sing Rachmaninoff now, and coming back on stage are the three soloists, Misha Didik, Svetla Vasilieva and Alexei Tanovitsky, with Gianandrea Noseda, to perform The Bells by Rachmaninoff. Thank you.
Стоит, и по пути, надежно возвещает о покое гробово.
A vision of a bell sobbing and groaning, proclaiming the stillness of the grave. The sonorous last movement of Rachmaninoff's The Bells melting into silence at the Royal Albert Hall, bringing to a close this celebration of the composer's choral music. So much of it still comparatively little heard. Gianandrea Noseda is a great champion of this repertoire, and he's beaming at the chorus of the Mariinsky Theatre, the BBC Philharmonic, and tonight's soloists, the tenor Misha Didik, soprano Svetla Vasilyeva, and the bass Alexei Tanovitsky. We brought that piece to such a spectacular conclusion. Alexei Tanovitsky is in fact a member of the Mariinsky Company, and he's applauding his colleagues in the chorus, and well, they're applauding back. Gianandrea Noseda was saying to me earlier that even in Russia, much of this wonderful choral music is still something of a rarity on the concert platform. Well, he's conducted it there, and he's certainly done his bit to spread the word here with the BBC Philharmonic by programming and recording it. And whistling and stamping for all the performers on stage now. Gianandrea Noseda, so delighted to be working once again with the chorus of the Mariinsky Theatre, whose appearance tonight has been made possible with the support of the Serge Rachmaninoff Foundation. And the members of the chorus have taken their seats again with the members of the BBC Philharmonic. I'm sure Gianandrea Noseda will be back with the soloists. As I said a bit earlier, all three of those soloists making their PROMS debut this evening. And here they are back on stage. Misha Didik, extremely sought after tenor at the moment. And he's achieved fame in one particular signature role as Hermann in Tchaikovsky's The Queen of Spades. Alexei Tanovitsky, as I say, regular member of the Mariinsky Theatre Ensemble in St. Petersburg, and that amazing bass voice much brought into play in Boris Godunov, for example, and Ivan the Terrible. Svetla Vasilyeva, I was saying earlier, great specialist in Italian opera. And that great cheer that you just heard is for the members of the Mariinsky Theatre Chorus. And the second cheer for the members of the BBC Philharmonic, and their chief conductor for just one more night, Gianandrea Noseda. Well, tomorrow's prom is going to be a very special concert again, as the BBC Philharmonic bid farewell to Gianandrea Noseda in his role as chief conductor. On the bill, Beethoven's 4th Symphony, Saint-Saëns' 5th Piano Concerto with soloist Stephen Huff, and Liszt's Dante's Symphony. That all starts at 7:30, live, of course, here on Radio 3. But the echo of that distinctive Russian choral sound and Rachmaninoff's clamour of bells is still resounding in our ears at the Royal Albert Hall. As I say, farewell from here, and hand you back to Katrina Young in the studio at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Penny. That was Penny Gore. And in case you missed any of that concert, or indeed you'd like to hear it again, you can tune in to Radio 3 on Wednesday afternoon at 2:00.
Performers and music lovers from across the globe come together for an inspirational weekend of music at WOMAD. Exclusive coverage on BBC Radio 3 of the UK's biggest festival of world music. WOMAD 2011. 8 hours of live world music performances from Wiltshire. On BBC Radio 3 this weekend.
And we'll be joining Andrew McGregor and guests for the final live session of WOMAD in just over 2 hours' time at 11:30. Well, having spent the last couple of hours in the company of Rachmaninoff, I thought we'd hear now from one of his compatriots and indeed contemporaries, Alexander Glazunov. We're going to hear a set of piano studies he wrote in the 1890s. Unlike Rachmaninoff, Glazunov was only ever a rather indifferent pianist. So when he was forced to perform his piano suite in front of an audience of composers and pianists, which included Saint-Saëns and Liszt, he was apparently so traumatised that he didn't write anything else for the piano for about 5 years. So these studies were in effect a comeback, and in fact they turned out to be among the most important piano works he ever wrote. On this recording, the Three Etudes, Opus 31 by Glazunov, are played by Martin Coombs.
Thank you.
3 Etudes, Opus 31 by Glazunov. The pianist was Martin Coombs.
In the previous series of More or Less,
Trumpton Fire Station,
the programme all about numbers.
Hello, this is the Treasurer of Trumptonshire County Council. Is that Captain Flack?
Yes, it is.
Please, will you or one of your team find Dibble and sack him?
Yes, of course, we will. Right away, right away.
It's one of the hardest phone calls I've ever had to make. It's not just the human cost. It's that I'm not even sure these cuts will help restore prosperity to Trumptonshire. There are plenty of people telling me that making cuts is self-defeating.
A World of Numbers, explained by Tim Harford. More or Less on BBC Radio 4, Friday afternoons at 1:30.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 9:15. And now another chance to hear a drama from the Radio 3 series which showcases cutting-edge new writing, The Wire. Award-winning poet, playwright and performer Lem Sisse didn't know another black person until he was 18. Recorded at a live performance, this is a whirlwind tour of race as seen from Lem's unique and intensely personal perspective, tales of pain and injustice which make you cry with laughter. Not afraid to say the unsayable, including occasional strong and racist language, Why I Don't Hate White People by Lem Sisse.
Every artist worth his salt at some time gets the invite. We leave our villages and towns, budding artists, braving the ridicule. He wants to be an artist. Poor lad. You'll not make any money doing that, love. And we carry our crosses, almost a badge of pride, and we go out into the world and spread our story. And we write our books, paint our pictures, make our music, create sculptures. And with a modicum of recognition, at some point in our what have become self-absorbed lives, a letter arrives. We understand you grew up in this area and wonder if you would attend our tick box here. Library opening, opening of new cattery, Robertson's jam lid opening, opening of our door, envelope opening. And we do it. I hereby open this envelope. It is an honour to open this door in my hometown. I have always wanted to open this lid. It's too tempting not to do it. And I declare this envelope open.
How was your journey?
She says, the organiser of the reading at Salford Community Centre. No problems whatsoever, I says. Smooth as a baby's bum. Probably not that smooth, actually, but smoothish. Cross between a baby's bum and an old lady's knee, I says, while remembering the standing argument with the train inspector who took an age checking my ticket. Note to self, she doesn't take to the baby's bum line. Silence. Well, that's good at least, she says. Or the taxi driver moaning about the new Polish drivers who don't know where they're going. I should have said to him, I should have said, mate. Because that's what people call you when they're not. Mate, what is your problem? That's how it begins, Holocaust. From an assumed distaste, distrust as default. Dis. If that's what he says about Polish drivers, what would he say about me? But I didn't, did I? I didn't say anything. Silence. How was my journey? She asks. Have you got receipts? Receipts? Of course we'll pay for you. There's two things I can't talk about. Money and money. I've got agents who deal with... But I don't say so, do I? Because I'd seem a so-and-so. So I don't. Oh, don't worry. It's no problem. No, if you show me the dressing room and the stage, I'll be right. Of course, what I didn't know is that having gone through all that contractual palaver... Love that word, palaver. It's like Pavlovia, or it's an Italian with no fear of active volcanoes. Palaver should be a dish, a Pavlovian palaver. And if I was wearing a pullover, I could have a Pavlovian palaver in a pullover. But having gone through all that contractual palaver, they decided on a fit of panic at the last minute that having not spoken to me directly, I might just not turn up. Would you buy a ticket at the train station and then think the train won't turn up because you haven't spoken to the driver? I've brought my books, I tell her. Is there a bookstall here? Silence. I'm afraid not, she says. We've been having some problems. Silence. I'm here to do a poetry reading, I says. Well, yes, she says. But no, you're not, she says. No, I am, says I. Well, you are, but you're not, she says. And then she tells me. She tells me everything. There's been a turn of events, she says. You've been away a long time, but you can help us. There's so much hatred here, she says. Hatred. And with the election. And we would like you to talk about why you don't hate. Hate what? I says. White people. Right. We're on. And she walks out in front of the audience at the community centre and introduces me. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Mr. Lem Cisse. Thanks. I'm on.
I was the only one. It was like being the centre of an anthropology experiment. I grew up as a child in the wild villages of Lancashire. Because if I grew up as an adult, that would be weird.
There's the laugh, the unifying milk of human goodness.
It was weird to be born an ethnic. Mother's laid in the hospital. Doctor brings me out. Mrs. Cisse, you've had an ethnic. A what? An ethnic. Take it away. Take it away. From 3 months old, I was in the care system of the mill and mining towns of our Lancashire. If you're in the care system, legally, the government is your parent. Margaret Thatcher was my mother. Let's not talk about, think about breastfeeding. The Queen was my grandma. They were white. I had foster parents too for 11 years. They were white. Then I was in children's homes. The staff in the children's homes, they were white. The shopkeepers were white. The market I worked on was white. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. The school was white. The entire town was white. The cotton mills had white workers that poured onto our white estate. The miners were white. The schools had white children in them. The teachers were white. History was about the victories of white people. English was about writers who were white. Physics and mathematics was about white inventors. The policemen were white. The doctors and nurses were white. The people at church were white. The pastor was white. The converted, right, were baptized by a white pastor in white robes in a pool with white tiles in front of a white congregation, and the hymn hymns that the white choir sung were written by white people, and Jesus on the cross was white. The disciples were white. All the characters in the Bible were white. The angels were white. God was a white man. Heaven was white. Batman, Superman, and Spider-Man were white. Fairy tales starred white characters, and you could tell which witch was a good witch because a good witch was a white witch. And a good lie was a white lie. And women got married in white because white was pure. I was the only one of them. And though that's the way it was, colour didn't matter. I knew this because people told me as I wiped the splatters of gargled phlegm off the back of my coat at school. Because what white people did was either spat on the back of my coat or told me race doesn't matter. It's the personality that counts. This was my first lesson about race. And it seemed it was theirs too. And every now and again, an old lady would stop me on the street and say, "Hey, there's good and bad in everyone, sunshine." Two questions. Why does race not matter? And what is there to be afraid of? The question of living life to the best of my ability was foremost in my mind, as it is in any child's. And to me, it didn't matter what colour you were, because colour doesn't matter. I was colourblind too. And with no guides in self-knowledge regarding race, was I in a unique position of seeing and experiencing how rural white people formulated their first ideas about race, unfettered by opinions that would later be deemed and damned political correctness. If there was one thing I knew, it's what the good white people told me. We're all the same under the skin. And I believe this wholeheartedly, that if you were to shave off my skin and everyone else's, we'd be absolutely the same. There were times later on in life where I did feel like a group slashing would make the point just as well. Group hug? And was there ever more an ineffective phrase than "sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me"? It translated as "don't call me names, but hey, try these clubs and rocks, they're much more effective." So I trundled through my first 10 years being clubbed and spat at, pelted and poked with the defensive platitude that race doesn't matter, it's the personality that counts. It had all of the intelligence of a man who saws off his own legs to step through a field of landmines. So here, in this town, our town, my town, I dived from the bridge of childhood into the cold waters of adolescence. Strange things started to happen beneath the surface. I'd noticed on my way to see friends when sat on a bus that people wouldn't sit next to me. Or the opposite reaction. There I'd be, sat on an empty bus, and an old lady would sit next to me because she didn't want to seem ignorant by not sitting next to me. After an awkward silence, she would release the question. "And where are you from?" I honestly don't know which is worse. I know I'm supposed to think that the old lady sitting next to me is better, but is it? Is it? She wasn't talking to me. She was talking through me. "And where are you from?" has to be one of the most belittling, self-serving, put you in your place and me in mine questions an old white lady could ask a young black boy. And as I stayed there, quietly, refusing to answer the question, she leaned over and she whispered, "There's good and bad in everyone, sunshine." just once in my life, I would love to have answered that question. I'm living on Market Street, and it's our first phase in a plan to take over your town. But I didn't, did I? I didn't. always smiled. And then she'd remark on my white, shiny teeth, in contrast to my dark, black skin. And this was a compliment, in the hope that my teeth never go yellow. Because what would she see then? A dark, black-skinned, yellow-toothed monster. I learned early on that this quiet village, our quiet village, would only let me be an extreme. I was either extremely gorgeous or...
The audience is quiet. Slight fidget. Slight slippage. Need to keep from slipping. Must keep from slipping.
I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady comes by. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away.
Lancashire! Get away, but anyhow, teenage years! And I started to go into pubs. It's the rites of passage for the white people of the region. In the deserts of Somalia, it may be circumcision. In America, it may be shooting your first deer and smearing the blood over your young and adolescent face. But in Lancashire, the rites of passage from youth to adulthood, the bridge, the stairway to adult heaven, aside from lamping, go, my son, to pub and order beer and packet of cheese and onion crisps. Then you shall truly be.
It was that kind of two pubs to a man town. Men drink bitter, the women drink lager. The kind of town where guys had names like Tony. Steve-o.
Jacko. Norman. Bit of a dickhead, Norman. But he's all right. Hey. Kind of place where men walked like they were pushing a wheelbarrow. Kind of place where guys weightlift their own nipples. Just to go, yeah, Tony, have a look at this. Oh, yeah, I can do it back as well. Hey, I'll tell you what, it were the kind of place, right? It were the kind of place where guys scratch the nuts in public just to prove they got bigger nuts than the next guy. And when one guy scratches his nuts, the other one sees him, he says, look, scratches his nuts, doesn't he? Prove he's got bigger nuts than the next guy. And when one guy sees him across the street, he scratches his nuts. To prove he's got bigger nuts than the next guy. Now, I know there's somebody out there thinks I'm driving a car. It were one big, nut-scratching, beer-swilling, army recruitment for a kind of town, eh? My kind of town.
It was the only town I knew. I was one of them, and they were one of me, as long as I could rise above it, whatever it may be. So anyway, I got to an age where I went into the hallowed and sacred ground of maturity. A place where I could get off my head and learn how to be a man. From the outside, it was warm, the pub. The windows were glowing golden light. I could hear the rumbling banter, the laughter, the collective noise of the north. I walked in, and it was like a Clint Eastwood film. I swear the place... The entire place went silent, stony silent, absolute silence. I could hear the beer drip from the pump into a stunned beer glass. All heads turn to the source of intrusion, then fully round and back again.
Yeah, Tony, have a fucking look at this.
A shaft of light spilled through the room. Men with square jaws and right-angled shoulders moved aside, holding their women back. Don't look at him, love. As the whole scene split down the centre, a corridor. It was almost religious, like the Red Sea, the bar glinting in the distance. The barwoman stood, sweat pouring from her forehead, staring at me. I said, behold, my people, I have come. What I didn't notice were the beer glasses bouncing off the back of my afro. Finally, I got there, the bar. The sacred ground, the holy grail of this God-fearing town, and when people realise that I'm an approachable kind of guy, which I'm not, actually, about 10 women would sidle up to me and say, can I touch your hair? Can I touch your hair? Can I touch your hair? A student would tunnel through with a massive spliff in his hand and say, excuse me, mate, have you got a light? Have you got a light? Another student would pop up and say, have you got any Rizlar? Have you got any Rizla? Then the one reggae record on the jukebox would burst into Bob Marley. I don't want to wait in vain for your love. A huddle of white women would sidle up to me and one would nudge the other, who'd nudge the other, who'd nudge the other, who'd look me in the eye and say, is it true then? Or what? Is it true then? Or what? Can I touch your hair? Have you got a light, mate? Have you got any Rizlaw? Have you got any Rizlaw? Have you got any Rizlaw? Is it true then? Or what? Can I touch your hair? It was like being in a glass-bottomed boat looking under the sea. Actually, I did have some Rizla, but that is not the point. Because I was the only one. Because like them, I'd never known a black person. I got a unique insight into them in their early uninhibited formation on the subject of race. The first time I met a black man, I was shit scared. What are they? All those subliminal messages festered at the front of my brain like worms eating away at my social skills. As the black man looked at me, unblinking, I looked back at him and he at me and me at him, and then I just blurted it out. Return ticket to Wigan, please. On the train, I thought, if I'm scared, what must my best friend feel? What does he do with the millions of pieces of information he's received? How does it make him feel? In childhood, all our references were the same. I was born here. I'm the son of these towns, this Lancashire. This is my Lancashire, but it was like being born in a one-way mirror. I saw them, but they didn't see me. They saw a distorted reflection that made them flinch, that made their guts react, that made them look away or stare in fear or hate. They were all I'd ever known, and yet I was all they'd never known. And yet, what did they see? Hey, what did they see? A journalist, right, says to me, doesn't the statement, why I don't hate white people, imply sort of, you know, like most black people do hate white people? No, I'm not implying. And I don't speak for most black people, like you don't speak for most white people. What makes you think I do? I'm genuinely on a journey of discovery and exploration to find out why I don't. A guy stands up in the audience, red-faced, round belly. You're right. Y'all know me. Y'all know me.
I've seen the best of you pissed. I've seen the worst of you sober. Integrate is not a northern compliment. Integrate. Race relations is not a dating agency. I don't want to talk about racism anyway. I don't want to hear this. It's a different matter to understanding white people. It's a different matter altogether. If there's anything I don't want to talk about, it's racism, okay? The organizer asks him to take a seat. Let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot be racist. Not because I am a black man. No, ladies and gentlemen, and others who prefer not to be either, which is okay with me. I cannot be racist because I once had a white girlfriend. And that kind of integrity does not come around every single day. And if I refer to myself as a black man, it doesn't mean to say I hate white people. I mean, I do. But it doesn't mean to say I hate white people. No, that's not true. Actually, that was a joke. Not the jokes about race are okay. No, that wasn't a joke about race. That was a joke about perceptions. My name is Lem Cisse and I am a black man. I know I'm a black man because I woke up this morning, I looked in the mirror and went, ooh, I must go out there into the streets and contextualize myself so that everybody feels okay. Sometimes I want to mug people just to get rid of the nervous energy. The idea that neither colour nor race mattered could get out of hand. I'd be out with my white friends somehow, someplace, somewhere, from someone. You're not a black man. You're a human being. You're a human being. You're a human being. What does that mean? I know I'm a human being. I know I'm a human being. What about me saying I'm a black man? Says that I'm not. Yes. Yes, sir.
So what you're saying is it's like a child in a mathematics lesson saying to the teacher, sir, now it could be Ms, could be Mrs, could be a first name only basis. Sir, do you know you're using numbers? If a woman says to me, I'm a woman, I don't say to her, no, love. You're a human being. If a man says to me, I'm a Wiganer, I don't say to him, no, pal. You are a human being.
Sometimes, sir, the most intelligent people will say to me, I don't see colour. I'm colourblind. Are you? Are you really? It's a freaking illness. It's like turning to somebody who's got one leg and saying, I don't see legs. Mentally, I am a paraplegic. How can people say, they don't see colour when they see colour? What I'm saying is that these ideas, they come from somewhere, from some time in our lives, uncontested. They have a root cause. Okay, so race doesn't matter. And so if race doesn't matter, neither does colour. Hallelujah. We're all colourblind. When I was the only black in this village, I felt myself actually becoming invisible. The more times I heard the phrase, I don't see colour, I'm colourblind. Hey, you're a human being. Hey, we're all the same, pal. Is my blood not red like yours, eh? Is it not?
We need to think outside the box. But how does anybody who thinks outside the box think outside the box? Who said it was a box? Somebody who says, let's think outside the box, has identified the box to think outside of. Who says that anyone was thinking inside the box anyway? Let's think inside the box. Nice box, yeah? Nice box. Nice box. An old man comes up to me, he says, what's racism like? I said, do you really want to know? Yes, he said, do you? I said, yes. He said, so I slapped him. He fell on the floor, and I leaned over him, and I said, how do you feel? So I and wider society can understand. Please, articulate yourself. Maybe write a poem about it. And to counteract these attitudes, ladies and gentlemen, I do slavery workshops. I've been doing them for about a year now. The workshop lasts an hour. I take a cigarette break, and then I come back for the other hour. If the teacher criticizes me, I say, don't oppress me. What I do is, and I have been very successful, is try to educate teenagers to what slavery is like. I chain up the children and force them into the corner of a room. And then they start to whimper. And that is when I take a cigarette break. I come back and I sit down and I wait for the bell. Another hour passes, the tears start. And just before the bell goes, I say, how do you feel? But before they can answer, the bell goes, and I say, that is the bell of slavery, the slavery bell, and I simply walk out. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is revolutionary teaching. The evaluation forms themselves, I have hundreds, that speak of the power of my workshops. There have been complaints. Only a few complaints. But I am bound. Let's just listen to the language there. I am bound not to speak about them for legal reasons. The workshop is simply called Chains. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe I've been looking in the wrong direction. Look there, audience, performer, stage, sound, lighting, community, center, ticket, usher, seat. We arrive like rain and depart like evaporation. You're as close an experience of family as I've ever had. There are as many black racists as there are white racists. There's racism from Ethiopians to Eritreans, particularly good example, that one. Racism from Jamaicans to Bajans, racism from Indians to Caribbeans, and vice versa. The lot of them. In fact, the truth is, if there is one thing that unites the human race, one thing is... Maybe we should have a concert. A racism concert. Where we all get together, kick 10 colours of shit out of each other, and then... Group hug. Thought not. All been to Spain. My mate used to go on holidays, right? Holidays to Spain.
Why don't you come, mate?
He says to me.
I've got a family there.
He says, so I do, I go. As you do. How was I to know about Spain? So we stay in a hotel, whole group of us, big hotel, Lots of white people from Burnley and Wigan lying by the pool like sizzling pink sausages. Nothing wrong with that. Working class people having a working class holiday on the new frontier, living la vida loca.
Hey, England's just not the same as it used to be.
You know that scene from the Hitchcock film, Birds, where that woman walks through hundreds of silent ones to the house and they're watching her with their beady eyes? That was what it was like walking through the pool area. Can't you see? I say to my mate, like they're watching me, like I shouldn't be here. Like, what's one of you doing over here with all of us? Like, we came here to get away from you, Law. Like I was spoiling the view. Don't be paranoid, came the reply. But when they get drunk, it floods out. It gushes out. The gloves are off and the defences are down. And I get love, white love.
Hey, hey. Hey, you're all right, you are. You are, you know. You're all right. I don't care what other people say. You're all right. I love coloured people. Hey, no, mate, I wasn't saying anything. Hey, come on, mate. I wasn't saying... Come on, man. Come on. Hey, stop it. Mate. You're a brother! Oh, you're a brother! Ah.
I was to be colourblind. I was becoming invisible. Here is a map of Britain. So, we know most black people live in the cities. Most of the white people come from the countries, the villages and towns around the cities. And you know what you find? They all live together. And they speak their own language. In their mid-teens, many of them travel to here, to the cities, where most of the black people live too. Often they go on holiday to Spain. As you can see, Britain from this height looks like a map. And from here, we do. We all look the same. Nice. Of course, once they've made their money in the cities, many of them move back to the country or out of it altogether. To Spain. Spain. What bugs me, what irks me, what puts iron filings in my boxer shorts is the way my white mate on holiday orders a beer. Because it's so easy. It's so easy. 2 pints of lager, mate. 1 whiskey and ice. And a packet of salty nuts. Cheers, yeah. And he gets better at it the older he gets. Yeah, 2 Pinot Grigios, 1 whiskey on ice, and a packet of cashews. Cheers. He becomes more skilled at white-on-white communication, but he wonders why he finds it so difficult to communicate to the few black people he meets. He wonders why there's always a problem. Maybe he becomes a TV producer, a policeman, a teacher, a social worker, a doctor, a shopkeeper, a council worker, an MP, a theatre director, a lawyer, a writer, and he finds himself wondering why he has to be so careful, why a joke isn't just a joke. Why does he have to question himself because he's a grown man now? Why can't the problem go away? And anyway, it isn't his problem, it's their problem. Why can't they just chill a little? Jeez, you can't even use the term blackboard anymore. Has the world gone entirely mad? He's gone from deciding that colour doesn't matter to believing that race is a problem. See, the thing is, he says, they all live together. If they just integrated a little bit more, the world would be a better place. He notes how they speak their own languages and how he never feels comfortable around them. He might even recall how once he went to a club where he was the only white person. The actual feeling of being a minority makes him want to share the experience with his only black friend. What it doesn't make him do is realize that the feeling that he'd had for a few hours in one night of his entire life is the experience I had had throughout all of mine.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, you all right? Hey, are you all right? What do you call a white man surrounded by black people, eh? Manager. What do you call a white man's favourite tool, eh? Chainsaw. Run, nigga, 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 nigga. Run, nigga, 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 nigga. Run, nigga, 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 nigga. Eh, just a joke, pal. Just a joke. Can you not take a joke, pal? Eh? It's just a joke, mate. Eh? Just a joke.
I think, personally, at this point, we should split up into small groups and discuss whether that was actually a relevant joke in today's society and in this particular environment. But to split up into small groups, we will need a worker to administrate the process as to whether that was a funny joke or not. We'll need funding to get that worker. So to get the funding for the worker, we'll have to come up with a constitution. And a mission statement, and we'll need a subcommittee for that. So we'll have a subcommittee to bring a constitution back to the management committee, which will consist of two members from each group, not forgetting capital funding, which we will need to house the worker, who will then set up the meetings for us to determine whether that was a funny joke or not. Finally, and at long last, we'll get the money, the capital funding, for a nice building, which we will call the Richard Pryor Centre for the Equality of Telling Jokes About All People. We'll set up an equal opportunities interview system, and then we'll get the worker who shall administrate the process so we can determine whether that was a funny joke or not. Finally, we're in the building, we're working the groups to establish the facts, we're consulting the community and evaluating the process as the process happens. But the problem is that the worker is a wanker. So what we will do is we'll set up our own committee to determine whether that was a funny joke or not, relevant in this particular environment, to make our world a better place. Group hug. But really, I don't want to talk about racism. I write books and plays and music, and race gets talked about as if it's part of some social eat-all-you-can buffet. Ooh, what's an ethnic? Ooh, what's a minority? What's an urban? What's an urban? I'm not an urban. I'm not an urban. A black man does not have urban parents. This language may be good for administration purposes, but it is unapplicable to me. I don't know one black person ever in my entire life who, outside of either a job application or some kind of official interaction, has used the term ethnic minority to describe themselves. In the 29 years that I've been on this earth, that term has been a misrepresentation. Language. The truth is, nobody's racist. Nobody at all.